accession number 28650, Mr. Gordon Mellor, Reel 10. Now, we're talking about your time with 27OTU at Lichfield from November onwards, 1941. We're looking at your thing. There's quite a lot of photographic reconnaissance type looking things.
Yes.
There's something called IR Target in North Wales, which looks
infrared.
Like
oh, yes.
Infrared tag.
Yes.
Now, tell us a bit about these sort of training flights.
Well, the photographs that you've got there are all taken in daylight, obviously. And they were almost a free choice. They were suggestions as to which ones we should take, which en route. The routes and courses we were to take were laid down so that the flight lasted how many hours, 3 hours or something like that. And we covered various sorts of terrain, so and we kept out of the way of the more serious aircraft operations, if any were going on.
Now, were you meant to be taking these photographs to prove you'd gone the right way, or was it just
improve one's knowledge and expertise, because most of them in this case were taken from high up, perhaps reasonably 6,000 to 8,000 feet, perhaps even up to 15. No, this is just to increase our experience. The cameras were largely the same. I tried to think of F-24s or something like that, I think they were called. But they still had this 5-inch by 5-inch camera film, and which gave them contact prints of the size that you can see.
And the other thing is, did you do any bombing practice?
Yes, that is so. We kept this going whenever possible at Cannock Chase. Of course, you had to sort of
be there
on a slot at a time, and had people observing where the hits were, taking bearings, so that they could plot how accurate you were towards the target. Now, Ralph and I sort of kept, both of us kept our hands in, but on some occasions then it was far easier for him to stay in where he was and I would do the practice bombing, and it saved him having to climb out of the front of the aircraft, get the door open so he could come out, and for him to do the necessary settings and drop six practice bombs. So I think I probably, out of the two of us, I had a bit more practice than he did. We did the only thing we could do at night was using an infrared target. These were spaced out around the country. I think there was one up in Shropshire. There's another one over in Anglesey, I think. And this was virtually blind bombing, because your progress in the aircraft was marked as a trace on how did they record it now? I'm getting a very hazy about this, the actual procedure.
Okay,
but the idea was that you would do a night bombing exercise, and it would be recorded, and you could see how close your navigation and your bombing take took you to getting a hit.
Anything else you were doing?
There's certainly an amount of lectures going on with
anything new
equipment. No, I think it was largely consolidation of all that we'd done in the past to get us up to speed and a reasonable degree of accuracy. We put in a fair number of hours at that time. Time slipped by. We were there over Christmas. Of course, we had to contend with Midlands weather, we had that particular winter, we had a fair amount of frost, and on the aerodrome there was a big hole, so to speak, which filled up with water. So it had every appearance of being a big pond. That froze over sufficiently for us to skate on. And I sort of got in touch with my mother and asked her to send me my skates and boots up. So I quite enjoyed that cold spell. Ralph Longmuir bought some boots, and he... well, that was purely an off-duty pleasure.
What else would you do for fun? Would you go as a crew drinking or into Litchfield or
not
Burton?
Not really. I used to go largely with Don Jennings into Litchfield, and we used to make a beeline for one of the cafes there. In actual fact, it's still there in existence to the day now, but obviously the different people own it and different people run it. We used to go in there for high tea, and we got to know the young ladies who were in service there. And we were always welcomed. After the second or third time, they recognised us. We went to the cinema on odd occasions. We had the odd beer, but neither of us were over keen on it. And down in one of the adjoining camps, perhaps I think it was the WAF camp or something of that style, then one of the officers started a fencing class, which he thought, well, we might as well have a little go at that. So, yes, we attended on a fair number of weeks. It was one night a week, I think, that we used to have instruction in fencing, and that was a break, an interesting diversion as well. There were dances and sort of the like, where all the station staff, male and female, got together. But I think it was mainly used by the permanent staff of the camp.
Now, around about this time, in February, there's an accident.
Looks
like on the 22nd of, 26th of February.
That's right.
Can you tell us the story? And also, it looks like we've got the wrong rear gunner, because the rear gunner's killed on this one. I think Crockett may replace him.
Ah, that is the point. No, it was Bill Godfrey.
It was Bill Godfrey, was your original. Well, we'll perhaps...
We'll have to correct.
It doesn't matter. We'll just. Tell us a bit about Bill Godfrey, your rear gunner, before we start. What was he like?
It was Bill Godfrey. He was he was a young lad. He was not much over 18 to 19. He came from Western Australia, from Perth, in fact, and he was a straight air gunner. And he had trained to act as such in the rear turret. I'm sorry, I
Easily done, because Crockett's your replacement.
Yes.
Now, tell us about this accident. What exactly happened?
This was an afternoon trip we took off, early afternoon, and we hadn't got more than, a quarter of the way around the aerodrome circuit. I suppose we've about gone up to a couple of thousand feet, probably no more. And I heard Don say that the one of the engines was not giving us much power, and they tried to sort of compensate for it with pushing up more power on the second one, but the it continued to deteriorate. We were continuing round the circuit, and we'd taken off towards Cannock, I think, in the first instance, and we were now swinging around on the outskirts of Litchfield. He said, we're not maintaining height, we're losing height. was sinking. So they put out what was to amount to an SOS to the control tower at the airfield, and they said, fundamentally, well, try and come round and land on the runway. Well, we continue to lose height quite a bit, and then Don said, get Ralph out. I don't know what term Ralph Longby was doing, but as I put him in, I sort of, right, let's get on with it. So I dived down into the nose and got the bulkhead out, because Ralph couldn't open it himself. He was stuck in the turret. And he clambered out as best he could. I think I probably tried to help him a bit. And we slammed the bulkhead shut, and he shot off up the stairs past the second pilot's position, going on down towards the middle of the fuselage. And I followed him and could see, we were close to the ground. In actual fact, I was still standing up, just holding on. I saw the Trent Valley Station, which is the alternative railway station to Lichfield, and quite close to the camp. Station just flashed past, and we were we were near enough to, just above the roof, and we hit down onto the adjoining field just the other side of the railway track. We must have hit nose first, because the aircraft bucked quite a bit, and I imagine that in that process we then hit tail first and then clumped down back onto the belly again, and we came to a skidding halt. Somebody said, everybody out, as far as I can remember. And I got the astrodome above me, which you can take out and use as an escape place. And I had a job getting it down, but eventually I did get it out, and went out shoulders first, or head first and then shoulders, and slid down the fuselage onto the port wing and down the wing onto the ground, and gathered myself together and walked round to the front, where the turret, which Ralph had been in, was down the field. It had broken off and rolled away. It would have injured him seriously. The rest of the nose of the aircraft was hardly there. And Don Jennings said, firstly got up out of his seat and walked straight out of the space where the nose had been, and so had Ralph. But having got some 10 or 12 feet away, then Don had collapsed, and he'd got a broken leg, broken ankle, or something like that. And he couldn't go any further. So the starboard engine was on fire, and we shot round to the back, and the only one left in the aircraft, of course, was Bill Godfrey in the rear turret, and he was trapped in there because the tail had made another hit on the ground, while the rest of the aircraft was, just sufficiently above the ground, and he was unconscious. He was breathing, but he was unconscious, and we were fortunate in as much that there were a number of people working on the railway. Now, that was the main line up from Midland Line, I suppose. It must have been from Euston. And there was also, at the railway station, there was an upper-level railway line which ran from Lichfield to Burton-on-Trent, so it crossed it more or less at right angles, but at a higher level. And it was just the roof of that upper part that we'd just missed, and these chaps were off of the railway and off the branch line, came running up, and they brought their tools with them, and whilst we were struggling to try and get some movement in the turret, we found it would be impossible, so they took over, and I knew I couldn't do anything. They were the best people to do it, and so I went round to the front, and there was petrol dripping out of both engines, and also from the tanks where the engine was on fire. So we borrowed a shovel, borrowed two shovels, I think, and now somebody else and myself, we spent our time shoveling earth onto the engine to put the fire out if we could, but there was petrol all over the place. Anyhow, it took them some long time to get young Godfrey out of the turret, 20 minutes I should think, and we shifted quite a bit of soil trying to get the fire damped down, but it just wouldn't go out. And when they said they got him out, we then left it, and we walked a bit away because there was a lane the other side of that single track branch line where the ambulance was, which had turned up, and we just stood and watched, and the fire just swept. Sorry, I swept. After we left it, then the fire swept down the fuselage. It was doped fabric, of course, on the skin, so that all burnt strongly, and the whole plane was engulfed in flame. And we didn't see the end of it. We piled into transport, and which had come from the camp. And Don was taken off in the in an ambulance, and Bill Godfrey as well. And the rest of us went back to Litchfield, which was Litchfield Camp, which was probably no more than about a mile and a quarter away. Yes, we saw the MO, and
had you been hurt? I mean, were you strapped in at all?
No, I was still standing up. I when we hit, I was standing up, holding on to one of the parts of the interior partitions of the aircraft, just where the navigator's table was. It wasn't until, as I say, I saw the station there just flash past us that I really realised how close we were to the ground. And as I say, we went probably, 300 yards at the most before we hit in the field adjoining. And we didn't seem to slide very far. We decelerated at quite a considerable rate. I was dead lucky not to get thrown right down the aircraft.
So what had happened to Bill Godfrey? I mean, was it impact damage, not the fire that had...
Oh, no, the fire was still, well, until he was out, then the fire was still contained up in the wing and a little bit of the fuselage. So it was mainly the engine and the wing and the, I suppose, the petrol tanks adjoining caught fire when we stopped shoveling.
So what happened next then? You got back?
Well,
to the medical?
Yeah, we had we were seen by the medical bloke, and that was... that we were sort of on night duty, so to speak, for 24 hours. One of the course members, one of the Australian pilots, came and knocked on our door in the hut and told us that Bill had died, and that he'd heard that Don had broken his leg or something like that, whatever the exact injury was. And he was in, a hospital called Burton Wood, which is up in that direction, Birmingham area. So we had a quiet 24 hours, and then it was a question of sorting out the mess. And this is where, as Don was no longer... able, Ralph was okay, we need another pilot. So this is where Jack Murray was came into the scene, I rather fancy he had crewed up with P.O. Douglas. I'm not sure. Jack was a very, very steady chap. Tall and Australian, of course, as all the pilots were there. And then we then also had the Australian rear gunner to replace Bill Godfrey.
This is Jimmy
Crockett. Yes.
Now, how was this? I mean, presuming it was very upsetting to you all to lose your crew members in this fashion.
Yes, of course it was. None of us has experienced an accident like that before. As a matter of fact, we hadn't experienced any accidents. I mean, you flew when you went up, and you came down, and everything worked, and everything was okay. But some of the Wimpies at OTUs had already had a lot of service, and normally with a sort of frontline aircraft, then Wellington or others, they would fly on one engine quite comfortably. But this one certainly, with the loss of the power of half of its motive power, then it just wouldn't hold a height, and we came down. And I think it must have been failing itself to a certain extent.
Did it make you nervous of flying for a while?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. Because they got us back flying again pretty quick. We didn't have long to sort of brood on it. And
so you just dropped back into the same drill?
Yes, we did. We'd picked up two new members of the crew from others who perhaps weren't quite as advanced as we were. The idea was the crews sort of go through the course at slightly varying success, I think. And some made progress quicker than others, and we picked up some who were from behind. And we did very well with them.
So you resumed
flying.
Now, and then, I don't know whether anything else happens before there's another accident, not long later.
Well,
this is on the 2nd of April, 1942.
That's right. We were getting on by then. We'd done a fair bit of flying. And again, I'm not sure whether it was morning or afternoon. Morning, I think.
10.15. 10.15,
right. Then, yes, it was morning. We went off. Quite nice day. We'd taxied down to the start of the runway, got signal to take off, and Ralph was acting as the senior pilot. Jack was on second pilot duties, and tail up, and we lifted off the ground, everything going normal, and then I think we sank back onto the runway. And we bumped like that, and then we were off again, and everything was all right. The only problem was they couldn't get the undercarriage up, so we sort of tried to get a look at it from the cabin, and the undercarriage seemed to be free, sort of swinging in the breeze, and so we circled round the aerodrome and appraised them of the what was happening. And the squadron leader in charge of the flying came up in another Wellington formated on us, and had a good look. He said, well, try diving and pulling up sharply, see if we can swing down to lock. We tried that. And there was no visible signs, so he said, "Oh, you'll just have to, you'll have to bring it in, but you'd better get rid of the petrol," which meant flying round and round. we could just as well have done a cross-country exercise and come back. But anyhow, we circled around the area for some time, and when the petrol fuel had diminished to a reasonable amount, then we made an approach.
Was that a bit nerve-wracking during that phase? I mean, you must have known you were going to crash.
Yes, we did. Yeah, I don't think we were very happy about it. But on the other hand, we thought, well, if it's controlled, then it was not going to be too bad. So, yes, we circled round, and I don't know that we did anything useful other than sort of did a bit of map reading, looking at the countryside, and using up fuel. And so we then made an approach, and squadron leader Bamford, I think it was. I think he was the CO. He was in, came up in the other plane and flew in formation with us to the starboard side. And we were making the approach, and there was a tiger moth on the runway. I think an ATA person had flown in, and they'd been given permission to land. Anyhow, the squadron leader said, get that bloody tiger moth off of the runway, which promptly happened. Their drones running normally. So we then went round again, and it was decided that we should land on the grass and not on the runway, so the runway could continue to be used. And so we ran down parallel to the runway and bumped down onto the grass. It made a bit of a mess. Didn't do the aircraft much good, but we were sitting in crash positions.
What are they?
The floor of the Wellington was above the bomb bay, and when you came to the end of the bomb bay, there was a dip down, and then there was duck boards or a walkway at a lower level. And the wireless operator and I I thought, well, we've got other places which are better than that. Anyhow, it was agreed that we should sit in the official places. So we sat down with our backs to the bulkhead at the back of the bomb bay, and there was the geodetic construction and bits and boarding down just below us. And we came down on the grass, and
did the undercarriage collapse?
Oh yeah, yeah.
Not really. It was just hanging loose, wasn't it?
No. Yes. Yes. So that actually, when we banged on the takeoff, then it must have rattled the fittings quite a bit, so that it would neither go up or down; it just swung. And so that was another expensive.
And how bad was the crash?
Oh, it wasn't nowhere near nothing like the other one at all. It was controlled, and what's more, he brought it down. And gradually sank us down onto the ground, so it crumpled the bottom up, and it bent the propellers, and I don't think a wingtip. I think the wings didn't sustain any injury at all. So it wasn't too bad, but it was one that we didn't really want, and we were all very heartily relieved, especially those of us who had been in the previous one, to be able to clamber out. We got out pretty smartish, I must say, and following that first crash, every time I flew, I used to go up to the dome, the astrodome, and I would open it. I made sure that it would open. I religiously did that. Every other time I flew from that point onwards.
That's because so
we could get out at least one way. In some cases, it was very stiff and hadn't been open for some time. And so I took that precaution. So that was a little bit of something I learnt at that time.